Okay, so the presentation by you gave the impression that this is a class in gymnastics, but it's a class in political science. And I just briefly want to start out and to motivate this by asking you, so what the big challenges of mankind are. Just talk to your neighbor. Occasionally in this class, you are allowed to talk to your neighbors, but only for a limited period of time. So think about 1 or 2 minutes. What are the topics that could be addressed in this class? And then I will ask you and give some overview what will be taught in this class. So today is the overview. Tomorrow we go then really into the theoretical foundations of what will be taught afterwards in the remaining 27 sessions. Okay, so discuss with your neighbors what are challenges that we should discuss. Okay, so I think we should now get your opinion of what the topics might be. It's a guessing game, but obviously also somehow your wish list of potential topics. So what are the big challenges? Big political challenges. I was discussing this briefly with the team here, the two sitting here in the fourth row. They were just exchanging names now. So, do you have an idea on what the big challenges are for mankind? Okay. So, everything I can promise you will be covered, what you have mentioned. We have one session on terrorism. We have one session on migration, where obviously the so-called refugee crisis plays a role. And within the next few weeks, we will talk about deterrence, including nuclear deterrence, crisis, interstate crisis. This will be quite a substantial part. So this will be covered. Any other topic that is on your wish list? Pollution of the environment. We have one session on the environment. I'm not myself a specialist, but I have some former doctoral students who have worked on this topic, so you will be tortured by the insights of my former doctoral students. Yes, global warming will be part of the discussion on the international environmental politics and nuclear weapons, not this nuclear proliferation, but also the current crisis between Kim and Donald. D. Donald, I'm D. Gerald, and he's D. Donald. This will also be a topic. Okay, international organizations will also play a substantial role, sometimes more indirectly, but we will have sessions where we look at international conflict management, for instance, and then obviously then also the role of the United Nations in that, and also organizations within the United Nations, like the Bretton Woods Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organizations. I mean, we will look at rebels. There will be a session on civil war, the mobilization linked to that. So these forces will also be discussed, although part of it is obviously something which most likely has been covered in the lecture on comparative politics, which is the topic or scheduled each summer semester. Yes, globalization will also be a topic, although nowadays, with our dear friend Donald Trump, it's rather anti-globalization or, like Steve Bannon says, globalism, the dangerous movement. But we will discuss these matters also, protectionism and these matters. So, anything else? 1 or 2 more topics somewhere from the back benches? Okay, so North Korea will be something which we will address during the coming week. So we will discuss about all the bloody things about non-cooperation, including political violence, terrorism, and so on, before Christmas. And after Christmas, the world will somehow become more peaceful. Then we will also address then the European Union. So just to summarize this a little bit, what the topics are. So we look at both interstate war, war between states, and intra-state war. And we mainly look at interstate war in the coming weeks. What is a war? How would you define a war? What is, let's say, a definition of a war that you could live with? It's armed conflict, so the sides which are engaged into this confrontation are armed, and both of them use it. Because otherwise it would be something like genocide, terrorism, or what we also call one-sided violence, where you have a perpetrator and you have victims who are not armed. So there are different manifestations of war, and it's organized. How intensive does the violence have to be in order to call something a war? Most frequently used definitions, and I will get back to them during this class, they have some minimum threshold of fatalities on both sides. And quite often a war does not just happen. There is always a crisis beforehand, so you need to understand the escalation beforehand. This will play a big role during the coming weeks, as I indicated beforehand. We have, frequently people have mentioned North Korea, and what we observe here in Southeast Asia are different arms races, China against its neighbors, but obviously also North Korea against South Korea, and the protector of South Korea, which are the United States. So that's a special form of deterrence, where you have a superpower protecting the interests of an ally. So alliances play a big role. And you see here the dynamics of what we call arms races here, nuclear arms races, the confrontation during the Cold War, with more and more nuclear warheads, and then when Gorbachev came to power, then the Cold War started to end, and we lived in the illusion for a long time now, until some months ago, that the risk of a nuclear confrontation is very small. So we will also address this particular topic. Then a third topic, which starts around Christmas time, is international political economy. We will talk about trade, finance, monetary relations between states, but obviously also about development. And development is quite often unequal across the world. And what you then have as a consequence is inequality between states, but also inequality, obviously, within states. Now, just a guessing game, you have a 50% chance of being right. Has the worldwide inequality risen in the last decades, or has it fallen? When you compare countries, it has fallen. And why has it fallen? This is one view, and this is something which is more or less an established fact. So this is correct. If you take into account how populous states are, so especially China and India have caught up, and if you would then take the population into account, then the inequality with regard to the developed world has fallen. But other continents, especially sub-Saharan Africa, have had until recently, obviously, a period of severe stagnation also in Southern Europe. So these are topics that we will discuss in this part of this class, which is under the rubric of international political economy. We will also talk about the European Union, and the European Union is the most institutionalized trade agreement, preferential trade agreement of the world. And you see here that you also have regional forms of cooperation, not only global cooperation. And we will talk about the functioning and the not so good functioning of the European Union towards the end of this class. So to systematize this a little bit, first, what is world politics or international relations, or what is the topic? What is crucial here from any definition? So in the textbook, that is the basis for the first two-thirds of this class, which is the textbook by Frieden, Lake, and Schultz. More information on that later on. They just justify the topic of world politics by the challenges that are present, but they do not give a proper definition of the topic in general. Such classes have for a long time been called international relations. This includes a certain bias, because then you also think about states which interact with each other. So my chair is called the chair of international politics, I think, which is more general, where you also look at non-state actors and how they affect relations with other states and other actors. So this is the more general term, and I use these terms here interchangeably. The important thing is that it's relations between states and the actors within these states. And then the next thing that is perhaps important here are the subfields within international relations or international politics. So there are four general fields. We start out the class with analysis of conflictual relations, political violence, crisis between states, and decision making that is linked to that. Then we move to the analysis of international political economy. This is sometimes then closely linked with the analysis of international organizations, cooperation between states. And then another topic, but which is largely subsumed under conflict processes, is foreign policy analysis, how states make foreign, create foreign policies, and what actors are influential. So this is the general structure of this class. If you look at international politics or international relations as a subfield within political science, it's one of the strong subfields besides comparative politics, to which I would subsume also then domestic politics, I mean German politics in this country, or American politics, and then obviously political theory. I will teach our theoretical concepts and different theoretical concepts. So my question to you is, what is a theory? But it tries to explain a specific phenomenon. And theories are hierarchically structured sets of hypotheses. So you derive theories based on certain assumptions or axioms, and then you have the general laws which are called theorems, and from these theorems you get down to specific hypotheses. And these are then explanations. So what is one hypothesis in international politics or a law that you wouldn't already know of before you came to this class? Yeah. So this is the so-called democratic peace theory, and this will be explained within one particular session. There are also, let's say, popular, similar kind of hypotheses like the MacDonald hypothesis, which is also called the Golden Arches hypothesis, that no two countries that have a branch of McDonald's ever have fought a war against each other. Which war contradicted this hypothesis, which was formulated by a columnist of the New York Times, Tom Friedman. It was formulated about 20 years ago, 1996 or 1995, and which subsequent conflict, interstate conflict, has contradicted this. So what happened? Which interstate war occurred towards the end of the 1990s? The Balkan Wars, and which one especially? Interstate war? So that was Kosovo, when NATO, led by the United States, bombed Belgrade. Obviously, the United States has many McDonald's, and in Belgrade, I think there were even seven McDonald's at the time. So you can reject this hypothesis if you formulate it as a law, as a deterministic law, and not as a probabilistic statement. So everything that I try to teach here is theoretically based. And what is important for me that you understand the basic concepts in international relations. So what you have to learn in preparation for the examination at the end of the class is not so much the facts. I assume that you know certain facts, and they are obviously important. I mean, we are not here in a fact-free university or in a fact-free institution like the White House in the United States. So facts are obviously important, but what is important here for you to learn and to digest is the theoretical concepts. So there will be on this we will have to focus. Okay, so let's then move to the more general theories, which do not play a big role in this class, but two of them will be particularly important in the next few sessions. And one of them is called then, and probably you do not see this clearly, is realism, or its newer development, which is called neo-realism. And opposed to this is quite often what is called then also liberalism, which has evolved into institutionalism and partly constructivism. So the focus will be on liberalism, institutionalism, and on neo-realism. These are, to some extent, attempts to come up with a general theory of international politics. I mean, the theory for which the two of us will receive the Nobel Prize for many, many years. But obviously, my skepticism already explains that such a theory can probably be not developed. These are more worldviews, these are ideologies. Realism basically means that, or realistic explanation of international politics focus on the power of states, on the capabilities of states. Arms and alliances are particularly important in this worldview. Liberalism and also institutionalism focuses more than on what happens within states. So the democratic peace is one explanation that tries to explain through the internal politics of states why relations between states might not always be conflictual and carry the danger of a confrontation. Okay. And institutionalism obviously also focuses on the role of international institutions. Realists say, okay, international institutions like the United Nations or the European Union, they are just paper tigers. They do not affect the decision making. And some liberal scholars, some institutionalists believe that this might not necessarily be the case. So I will come up with certain theoretical explanations that are important here. Okay, so when you think about explanations about international phenomenon, you can explain this by focusing on the individuals who make decisions. And obviously, at the moment, quite some of us are afraid of particular individuals whom we do not perceive to be mentally that stable or who might have somehow a dangerous political agenda that they pursue. I do not mention names. I mentioned one of them already and too often. So why is a focus on individuals perhaps not always the best way to explain international politics? Think about how our decisions are made about whether or not a state goes to war. Who makes a decision in Germany on whether or not the German government supports a certain intervention by NATO? So Parliament, there is a proposal by the government, but it needs to be ratified. You need to get the support of Parliament. So for certain decisions, a focus on the individual decision maker might not be adequate. So you see, you have certain constraints. But on the contrary to that, what kind of decisions might or can be explained through individuals? What kind of decision-making processes in international politics are largely influenced by decisions by individual decision makers? Terrorism, where you have always some sort of terrorist organization, but it's a hierarchical organization most often, and then the top guy gives the order, and you have then the soldiers who deliver the attacks. Another example where the individual might be important. An authoritarian leader, and this is what some theorists think, faces fewer constraints than someone who acts within a democratic system where you have a certain checks and balances institutionalized. But I was thinking about decisions on war and peace within a crisis. So you know about the American president carrying his nuclear bag along and then, okay, I get back to Dear Donald, then he puts it on his holiday resort so that everyone can see this bag, and this is obviously then quite a dangerous situation. So when you think about crisis decision makings, these are always quite often individuals or small groups of individuals who make the decision. So this first image, how this was coined in the end of the 1950s by Kenneth Waltz, so we will get back to him in 2 weeks' time. This is a perspective that has been derided, but for certain contexts, this is still something which helps you explain decision-making. Okay. Margaret Thatcher, the British Prime Minister, said there is no such thing as a society, there are only individuals, and obviously a state is also only a construct because the individuals within a state make the decisions, but it's quite fruitful for international relations to focus then on the state as an actor, when you, for instance, think about democratic peace explanations and so on. And what has been propagated by realists, oh, now I have to get back. By realists, is the so-called third image, where you look at the structure of the international system. And the key hypothesis by realists has been that systems with a balance of power or bipolar systems are more stable, experience less wars. Why should the bipolar system be more stable? So think about the Cold War, Soviet Union and the United States. Why should this be relatively peaceful? Both sides are, in this perspective, sufficiently powerful so they can deter each other. And when you have nuclear weapons, what does then deterrence mean? It means that both sides can annihilate the other side. An attack is basically a way towards suicide. Okay, so this is something that we will discuss, and obviously also the difficulties that are linked to this sort of explanations. What will be clear here in this class is that we talk about a multitude of actors, and you can think about here obviously the state as an actor, but also the actors within the state that form the foreign policies. So you have on the one hand the government, you have parliament, you have voters, you have parties, you have business associations, trade unions, and so on, which try to affect a certain economic policy of a state. Think about Brexit and so on. And then you also have the civil society with non-governmental organizations, and they all pursue their own interests and affect then decision-making. At the higher level, you also have a civil society that is organized transnationally. And for this, you have then international non-governmental organizations. Some British guys have also a further acronym that call certain types of INGOs bingos. These are business interest groups. So these are one form of actors, but then you also have institutions at international levels, and these are international organizations. And states are parties to these international organizations. Think about the UN, which is a universal organization, but also about the NATO or the European Union, which only then are uniting a subset of states, of like-minded states. Okay, so what will be crucial, and I will explain this tomorrow morning at 8:15, is the perspective that focuses on the three I's, interests, interactions, and institutions. So my own worldview, but also the worldview that is propagated through the textbook for this class, is a strategic one, that in international relations, all decisions that are made are collective decisions. So you always have more than one actor that affects a political outcome here. And in order to understand this, you need to know the preferences, the interests of these particular actors. You also need to know how they interact, I mean, what kind of strategies they pursue in order to reach their goals. And then obviously, institutions put certain constraints on the decisions made by actors. Institutions are not powerless. Okay, so institutions are, in this definition, a set of rules. Now, my question is, what are the rules when you think about negotiations between states? What is the decision-making rule that is crucial for the interactions in the European Union? Think about the summit recently, where they discussed also the Brexit negotiations. How are decisions made in the European Council when Angela Merkel sits around the table? It's consensus, but the decision-making rule consensus is basically the outcome consensus. Everyone has to agree. So how is this decision-making rule called? When you think about the Bundestag, I mean, will be formed today, the new Bundestag. How does the Bundestag make decisions? So they take votes. And they also take somehow votes in the European Council, but it's a consensus vote. What does this mean? Instead of majority voting, what kind of voting do you have? So it's unanimity. Everyone has to agree. And for most decisions in the international level, you have a unanimity threshold. Every state has to agree on a change to the status quo. And this explains why it is very difficult to change the status quo, to come up with a particular political reform. So this is the perspective that will be crucial, and I will give you a short introduction, a very short and superficial introduction to the basic the basis for that, which is expected utility theory and game theory tomorrow morning. So be most excited about this. This will follow tomorrow morning at 8:15. Okay, let's now move to the organization of this class. I expect you to come prepared to this class. This means that you have to do the required readings, which are listed in the course outline. You find the course outline on ILIAS, and you should subscribe to this class on ILIAS. And if you do not know what this is, please talk to your neighbor after the class on how to get access to ILIAS. And there you find the course outline, which lists for every session the required readings, but also some additional voluntary readings. So international politics is a very research-active field. You find hundreds of articles, thousands of articles, which are published every year. But here in this introductory class, obviously, we use introductory material mainly for the preparation of the individual class. And first, we have the book that I have mentioned, which is the textbook which we will use for many of the classes, not for all of the classes, until January. And then after January, there's there are the sessions on the European Union, and there I use the textbook by my friend from the London School of Economics, Simon Hicks, and his former student, Bjørn Hjørland, from the University of Oslo. I did not assign this book because this is written by friends of mine, but because it's the best textbook on the European Union. I also know these guys who are at Harvard University, Jeff Frieden, David Lake is at the University of California at San Diego, and Ken Schultz is at Stanford University. Anyway, so you should acquire these books. There are also copies of these books and at the library. They are in the section of Dirk Leuven. I didn't move them from Dirk Leuven section to my section. Dirk Leuven was teaching this class the last time, so you find additional copies of this book there. So look at the or read the third edition of this book, which was published, I think, in 2016 or 2015. Okay. The book by Simon Hicks and Bjørn Hjørland is a little bit dated. They are working on a new version, but this new version will not be available before the end of this class. But the basic concepts that are included here are still obviously valid. Okay. And then you will also have additional readings. Sometimes they are simply survey articles, but what I will also include then are some journalistic pieces. These journalistic pieces are, I hope then at least what we can discuss in the class and in the tutorials. And these journalistic pieces can also serve as examples for the two essays that you have to write in this class. Okay, so here just a summary. I've mainly covered this already, 28 sessions. So you see here a brief exposition into realism, neorealism, liberalism, and then neoliberalism, and then we talk about political violence in November and December, and then we move slowly towards international political economy. Then Christmas will arrive, hopefully with many presents for you. And after Christmas in January, we continue with international political economy and move then slowly, and move then slowly towards European Union decision making. The last two sessions will be interrupted by what is called here Fasnet, which is carnival, which is something quite wild. So you will, if you are for the first time in Constance, you will experience something relatively anarchic and, okay, given Constance standards. Okay. I could also mention that I'm always dragged with my neighbors into a small carnival group, the seven poisonous dwarfs, so, but you might not recognize me then, and I have not yet decided whether I will join my neighbors this year. Okay. Okay, so some of the goals and rules of this class that I want to mention here. Please read the assigned materials before class. Please be prepared. And for the preparation of the final examination, it is not sufficient just to inhale all the slides that I will provide. So you should be able to work actively with the material. And in order to do so, you need to read these texts. And these texts will then also be discussed in the tutorials, and I will get back to the tutorials in quite quickly now. Okay, then the next thing is that you have to write two essays in contrast to the class taught by Dirk Leufen, who taught the class in German. You only have 800 words at your disposition for your essay, so I will provide a question, and you have to write an essay on this question, answer this question, basically within 1 week's time. And then in the end, we will have an examination. The next slide just gives you information about the dates for these assignments. You cannot participate in the final examination if you have not submitted two essays. These essays have to be uploaded on the web pages of the tutorials in which you will make part. And you see here, you have basically three possibilities to, or three dates from which you can choose when to submit your individual essay. I will say something later in this class on how to write proper Shakespearean prose. I'm an expert on that, obviously. And then I will also say something probably only very specific in January about the final examination, which will be most likely 100% multiple choice kind of examination. You have then 90 minutes at your disposition, and there will be a mock examination in your tutorials, so you will be prepared for this final examination. When I taught this class the last time, students were a little bit too frustrated because they thought, okay, the class is very, very difficult. Schneider is a very demanding guy. But then they thought, okay, this multiple choice examination was a little bit too easy. So don't panic because of me. But I mean, the multiple choice examination is still something also which you have to fulfill, but you can easily obtain here a good grade if you are well prepared, attend the lectures, go to the tutorials, and so on. Okay, so let me then move here to the organization of the tutorials. There are 8 tutorials all in all. Okay, so are there questions with regard to the organization? So then now go and run for your tutors.